Good morning. I'm Leslie McCartney, and I'm here with Flora Grabowska. Hi, Flora. Thank you for joining.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Today is Monday, May the 9th. It's 2016, and we're in the sound booth at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And I want to thank you, Flora, for coming in and talking to me today. And we're going to be talking about your career and your involvement with the Polar Library Colloquy.
Well, it's always fun to talk about how we got where we are here today. In my case, I was born in Aberdeen, Scotland, grew up there, attended high school there, however, chose to leave home and go all the way to St. Andrews University, a whopping 80 miles away. But that was a big deal in the 60s. Hardly anybody from my high school class left Aberdeen. They all mostly went to Aberdeen University. I had a great time at St. Andrews University, actually managed to graduate despite this great time I was having.
What did you study, Flora?
I studied biochemistry, which had everybody in an uproar when I was leaving high school. The English teacher said, no, this is all wrong. You should be doing arts. And the science and math teacher said, no, this is all wrong. She's not very good at science. But I had come across a statistic that of those women who actually graduated from university with an arts degree, and who actually then did go into a career and didn't just get married and have kids, well, I shouldn't say just, but those who went on to employment after graduation, 80% of them ended up as teachers. And that to me was a frightening statistic. Both my parents were school teachers, and that was not my, you know, I had no idea what I did want to do, but I knew that I didn't want to become a teacher. So I thought, right, I'll do a science degree, then I should have the statistics aren't so overwhelmingly weighted in that direction. So that was what I did. And sure enough, I graduated by the skin of my teeth. I certainly wasn't brilliant at it, but it was interesting. And no notion of librarianship back in those days. I became a bench scientist, a research assistant, back in Aberdeen, which again hadn't been my intention. I thought I'd left home and I was now off to the wide world. But it so happened that the job that I got in graduation was at the Macaulay Soil Research Institute.
Hmm. And what were you researching then?
It was in the plant physiology department. And one experiment that was quite long term was growing lemna, which is pond duckweed, but growing it in a solution of salicylic acid. And quite why, you know, and we thought this would be a good idea, I'm not sure. But it certainly altered the plant's metabolism and altered its behavior. So I remember studying that. Also studied potato sprouts. And potato sprouting and so on. However, this by this time was the 1970s, and there was a miner strike, and Britain was just suffering horribly economically, and life became very difficult, particularly in Aberdeen, because meanwhile Aberdeen was discovering this oil boom and the effects of the oil boom, which basically priced Aberdeen out of the reach of most Aberdonians if you weren't in the oil business, which I wasn't. So in order to make ends meet, I was a barmaid 3 nights a week in addition to a full-time job. And, you know, that was fun. I was in my 20s, but I was struggling. And meanwhile, my dad had emigrated to Ottawa, Canada, and I'd come to visit him while Britain was enduring these blackouts and cold misery. And Ottawa was much colder, but nobody was cold because they had heating, they had lights. And I was shocked. The Bank of Montreal just left its lights on all night long. And I thought, what a terrible waste. And then I thought about it some more. And I thought, well, if I have to be living at either extreme of too much or too little, I'll choose the too much and I can turn off my own lights. But in the too little, I can't even turn them on. So I set about emigrating to Canada.
Can I just ask why your dad immigrated to Ottawa?
Yes, he was actually Polish. That's why I've got the name. His name was Grabowski because he was male, but I was born female. My mum who was Scottish, all the Polish wives addressed her as Pani Grabowska. So when I was born a female, she just called me Flora Grabowska. So that's my name. And my dad's brother hadn't, so they both left Poland during the war, ended up in the UK when the war ended. But my uncle made his, he was an engineer, made his way through Argentina and then to Canada. And my dad visited him a few times and thought that the Canadian life was really attracted, you know, he loved the outdoors, canoeing and so on. So when my parents' marriage broke up, my dad took off for Canada. So, and it was a very bitter breakup between my parents. So I knew if I moved from Scotland to Canada, my mum would think I was going to daddy, and I didn't think I was doing anything of the kind. So I opened an atlas and picked the furthest away place from Ottawa, and that was Vancouver, Victoria. I knew nothing about it. But that's, I just, the plane stopped in Vancouver and I got out there and had a great time, as it turned out. So I went there and as a bench scientist, got a job in the biochemistry department at UBC, I was just reminiscing about this recently, prepared a hemoglobin sample for Max Perutz, who won Nobel Prize for his discovery in hemoglobin. So he happened to visit the biochemistry department and thought that he would try and take a look at rainbow trout hemoglobins, which was, I was working on non-histone proteins, which we extracted from trout testes, was one major experiment. And another experiment had to do with the genetics and protein markers in fruit flies. So when I was going to parties in Vancouver and people say, well, what do you do? And I say, oh, I work with testes and flies. And I'd watch the men instantly drop their hands to protect their... Anyway, so that was my days in Vancouver. And, you know, I was having fun and earning definitely was easier and better than it had been in Scotland. But I became pregnant, but was not really intending marrying the father. I've never regretted either, actually. And that was an opportunity for me to think about my future. I could see that this bench scientist was fine for me in my 20s, and I was with young 20s people doing their PhDs and postdocs, but I could see they were going to graduate, move on, new younger graduate students would move in, I would just grow older and older. And I thought, you know, I don't think this actually is a long-term proposition. So I cast about for, well, what would I do if I wasn't doing this? So I did think about becoming a daycare worker, realized that that wasn't a job that you would make a living at. It was a job you might love, but you'd need some other means of support. I thought about becoming a doctor, but didn't get into medical school. I thought about becoming a dentist, didn't get into dental school. Then I thought, well, I could become a science teacher in high school, and didn't get into Simon Fraser's education program. So at this point, I was a bit insulted and thought, for goodness sake, this is ridiculous. But a friend, another lab assistant like me in the physiology department, said, no, you're looking in the wrong places. You would hate the education scene as it currently is in British Columbia. There are no jobs, just in blackboard jungles. You'd be miserable. You have a science degree. The government of Canada will actually pay you to go to library school. Oh, I said. So he was right. And the point there was that the National Research Council of Canada had all these operations, research operations across the country, and they realized that most graduating librarians had arts backgrounds, and they thought it would help science research endeavor if there was a librarian that could speak the same language as the researcher. So that was the intent behind this NRC grant for librarianship. So I did that, went to University of Western Ontario.
So you moved to London then?
I did, but I was homesick there, not for Scotland. By this time, I'd become very Canadian, and I was homesick for the West Coast. So I wouldn't even, there were people wanting to come, wanting me to interview in Windsor, in Ottawa, in Montreal. And I said, no, there's no point wasting their time. I'm going back to the West Coast, which again, without any knowledge of the situation. And when I got to Vancouver, there were no jobs. And there was a mail strike. So, however, I found a half-time temporary position as a hospital librarian at Lionsgate Hospital. So that got me through the summer. And the University of Calgary knew about me. They tracked me down and contacted me and would I agree to be interviewed for a position. And by this time, I was quite desperate. So, which was, the timing was perfect because if they'd contacted me on graduation, I'd have said, no thanks, I'm not going to Calgary. That's not West Coast. But now, you know, I needed something. So that was my first full-time library position in the Environment Science Technology Library at the University of Calgary.
And how did you like Calgary?
I hated it at first. I thought I'd landed in a totalitarian state. There were 84 members of the Legislative Assembly. 82 of them were, what did they call themselves, progressive conservatives or something. No, they, whatever they were, they were far to the right of my thinking. And they had to act as their own opposition because, you know, I think there were two NDP members and two independents who were even further right. Now, I have not made the numbers add up, but you know, anyway, it was. And they hated Pierre Trudeau, who I quite admired. They hated the National Energy Plan, and they hated, the word liberal was a dirty word, you know, so. I found it a very tough adjustment, and it was very dry, burnt ochre colors. I landed there in August, and I'd come from very green, lush Vancouver. So it was difficult to begin with, but it was a very friendly place, and I quickly made friends, and I had a job. And that job was the beginning of my acquaintance with the Polar Library Colloquy.
And how did that happen? Because you just said you were working with environment, right?
Well, the University of Calgary Libraries had a tall tower and a squat tower. The tall tower had 7 floors and the squat tower had 4 floors. And so the squat tower was the where they put the science collections, and environmental science was, you know, coming into its own. And this was 1981 by this time. So I think they felt it was a good idea to put the word environment, and technology was there because that was where the engineering collection sat. However, just a year or so before I got there, AINA, the Arctic Institute of North America, had found funding difficulties in Montreal, where it had been based, and agreed to move to Calgary because Calgary had money in those days.
Was this also around the time of the Quebec referendum? Was that around the same time when a lot of companies were leaving Montreal because of the referendum?
I don't think that was then. There were certainly...
In the 90s, maybe.
Yes. I can't remember. Right. There'd been more than one Quebec referenda, but certainly the Parti Québécois was, you know, had made itself big and were saber rattling all the time. And I think that hadn't done the finances of Quebec and the finances of McGill University. I can't remember if AINA was attached to McGill. It seems to me it must have been, but. Anyway,
they decided to go to the University of Calgary and set up shop.
Yes, University of Calgary offered them a home, which there were some rumblings. Calgary and Edmonton, of course, were always in competition with each other. And Edmonton already had the Boreal Institute, mm-hmm. which now has a different name. Can't remember its current name. Begins with a C. Why would it be a C? C. I can't think. Mm-hmm. And the librarian for the Boreal Institute was Nita Cook, mm-hmm. who was a big, big player in what was, in fact, I think she was one of the founders of what was then called Northern Libraries Colloquy. Mm. Now, I would work with the Arctic. So the Arctic Institute had its own collection that got moved from Montreal, brought to Calgary, and kept intact as a library within a library in this environment, science, technology. And one of the existing librarians was designated as the Arctic Institute librarian. That wasn't me. But, you know, we all did turns at the reference desk, and so I would get familiar with the question, with the collection, and so on. So, but at that time, I didn't... I knew there was an Arctic Institute of North America. I knew it had a library. I still didn't quite know about the colloquy. And so this was 1981, I came to Calgary. As the year progressed, I got wind of the fact that there was a colloquy and it was going to be at the University of Tromsø, and that nobody was going to represent the Arctic Institute collection. Because that librarian just, you know, he had a young family, he wasn't interested, was too far away.
What was his name, Florida, you remember?
Bill Maas. Oh. And he went on to become director of Winnipeg University Library.
Oh.
He may have retired now. I'm not sure if he's still there. Last time I looked, he was still there, but he may have retired.
So you had this opportunity to go to this?
Yes, I put my hand up. I said, well, look, I can do this quite cheaply for you because I'm going to Scotland anyway. You don't have to fly me across the Atlantic. I'll pay that portion. You just have to get me from Aberdeen to Tromsø, thinking that would be inexpensive. Well, it wasn't. It was shockingly expensive, but the University of Calgary coughed up. So that was my introduction to the group. There wasn't internet in, this was 1982, so there may have been a printed newsletter. I don't remember if I saw it prior to hearing about the group.
Right.
Oh, yes, you got the information.
Yeah,
about
it was the ninth. So that 1982 was the ninth Northern Libraries Colloquy. And it was a cooperative efforts for the Scandinavian Library. So that must have opened up a whole new world for you then, really.
It certainly did. And now, arriving in Canada, mm-hmm. part of my education, so I came to Canada in 1974, part of my education was wiping the word Eskimo out of my vocabulary and replacing it with the word Inuit. And of course, now I'm back here in Alaska, I've had to bring the word back in.
I still can't bring myself to say the word.
Yes. Anyway. but, you know, Inuit's not their language, you know,
right.
here. Makes no sense to them to be referred to Inuit because they're not. And I understand that. One of the first presentations at this Tromsø colloquy was a Sami anthropologist who explained the term Sami to us and Sami land and Sami language and Sami culture. And the more I listened to him, the more it sounded like the Inuit story. And then he further confirmed that by explaining that what the word Sami meant was the people, mm-hmm. which I knew was what Inuit meant in that language. Mm-hmm. It meant the people, which always makes me wonder, well, what are the rest of us then? but I did find that, you know, that little extra education fascinating. And I had a small presentation to give. I talked about the Arctic Institute library and its collection and the use of it and the arrangements made by the U of C. But one of the most interesting things about standing up, it was a small group, mm-hmm. which is why they call themselves colloquy. Oh, and in a fantastic facility. The University of Tromsø was brand new. Mm. It was just opening that year. It only had two buildings. One of them was this newly built library. Everything finished off with beautiful Scandinavian interior, you know, blonde wood everywhere. It was totally gorgeous. And brand new to all of us from North America, a wireless mic. We didn't understand when they handed us a mic and it wasn't connected to anything. It was just this little rat tail dangling from it. But anyway, we, you know, figured it out and managed to cope. But, you know, it was interesting that we had to go to the northern reaches of Norway to learn this new wireless technology. Excuse me. So the Norwegians were fantastic hosts. You know, they went out of their way to explain this northern part of Norway and this Sami part of it. And they extended their wonderful hospitality. Oh, and of course, they spoke brilliant English, so the fact that we knew Norwegian. Although as an Aberdeenian, I do know some Norwegian because we say kirk in Aberdeen for church. We say bairn for child. And we say ale for beer. So, with those three words,
all the important things,
I was quite well equipped to manage my way about Tromsø. But yeah, people spoke beautiful English. However, alcohol was very, very tightly controlled, and you could only buy it certain days of the week and certain hours of the day. Which didn't matter to me. I'd come with a great big duty-free bottle and didn't think I was that heavy a drinker anyway. But one night, maybe the third night of the conference, our Norwegian hosts held a wine and shrimp reception. The shrimp was totally delicious, you know, fresh out of the sea, and white wine. So, you know, this very pleasant and everyone was having a nice time. But the Norwegians, as we were all mingling together, all the guys had a flask in their jacket pocket. And to show how friendly and what good hosts they were, they'd insist in pouring something from their flask into my glass, whether I had something in my glass or not. So I started out with white wine, but, you know, it would get totted up with vodka, with aquavit, with rum, with whiskey. And I had no sense. And I kept sipping away at this and at some point seated myself and joined a group and chatting away. Didn't realize. Oh, and of course, Land of the Midnight Sun, which I never actually saw because it was grey and drizzly the entire time we were there. But I'd no sense of the passage of time. It just wasn't getting darker. And this tripped me up into not calling a halt. So luckily, my friends, you know, as the party was thinning out and we were down to just a few of us, they said, oh, come on, Flora, we're going back to the residence now and there's a taxi at the door. Great, I said, stood up. And the term legless wasn't known then, but that was when I discovered the term. So I had a slight moment of panic because I didn't know if I could make my way to the door. It was across the atrium. It seemed an endless distance on black and white tiles. Anyway, I did. I put one foot in front of the other and got myself into the taxi. And this gave me a false sense of sobriety or something. Because I said, oh, let's come back to my room. I've got a bottle of Tutti Free. So people did. And we certainly didn't need any more, but so eventually they left. Eventually I went to sleep, woke up late the next morning. Now I was a new librarian. I'd only been in my job a year, and this was a big deal to me that I was at an international conference, and I felt terrible that, you know, it's 9 o'clock in the morning and I'm not there. So I thought, well, if I skipped a shower, I wouldn't be so late. at that moment, I knocked over some undrunk liquor on myself, and I thought, well, I have to have a shower now. So in the shower, I thought, well, if I don't wash my hair, I could save some time. But I couldn't stand steady enough under the shower to not get some. My hair was wet anyway, so I thought, oh, I may as well just wash it. And now I was feeling queasy. So I thought, you know, I just better go and get some Ryvita and a coffee. Maybe that'll settle me. And I'm late now anyway. So now the breakfast room was a different building. And as I said, it was always drizzling. So and it wasn't warm weather, even though it was late June. So I had on my only pair of pants, which happened to be mustard colour. I had on my only sweater, which happened to be a tangerine Shetland wool that my mum had knitted. And I put on my raincoat to go outside because it was raining. The raincoat was pink metallic. When I got to the breakfast, which was self-serve buffet, oh, delicious, all kinds of herring, all kinds of cheese, all kinds of cured meats, and all kinds of crisp bread, and wonderful coffee and fruit juice. There were a few people also there, and they stared at me. So I thought, well, what are they staring at? They're not at the conference either. You know? So since I wasn't feeling very bright, I elected not to go and join them, but just sat quietly by myself away from them. And at some point, I put my hand up to the back of my head to see if my hair was drying, to discover I had never taken out this big 9-inch bright yellow plastic comb that I had started combing my hair with. So at that point, I removed it, feeling very glad I hadn't proceeded to the conference with this appearance. So that was it. Punk goes to Norway. That was my first very friendly encounter with Polar Library Colloquy Group and Nita Cook, I started mentioning that the contention about Aina going to Calgary is I feel some people at the Boreal Institute felt it should just at that time have amalgamated, become one thing, and consolidated in Edmonton. But, you know, a bit of competition, and they chose different areas of focus, so it really wasn't duplicated effort.
So when you came back to Calgary after the conference, were you still in the environmental sciences part of the library then? Or
I was. That was 1982. And shortly after the university was falling on a bit of harder times, and so we're doing a periodical review looking for journals to cancel. And everybody's areas of responsibility got shifted around. So I had not been responsible for physics. I had been engineering and nursing, some interesting combination like that. But now I was an engineering librarian, was hired, and I took on physics, chemistry, and some other thing. So now I had to deal with the fallout of what the previous physics liaison had put on as potential physics journals to cancel. And this very angry physicist came storming in, wanting to talk to the physics liaison. And I said, well, that's me. Well, he said, and slammed down this journal. How could you possibly think to cancel this journal? So I explained, well, we had to make cuts, but we weren't cancelling anything right away. This was an opportunity for feedback, and I was very glad he'd come in to offer feedback. And we looked at the journal together. And the thing is, it had an Italian title, but in fact, most of the content was English. So I think it had been put on the list with the notion that it wasn't even an English publication, but that was wrong. So I said, oh, no, if you use this journal, we won't cancel it. But since you care so much about the library, perhaps there are library services that you might benefit from, I said. Oh, yeah, he said, like what? I said, well, SDI, that is selective dissemination of information. This was before Reagan and his Star Wars. So he got interested in the idea, and he said, well, how would I get one of those? And I said, well, you would talk to your liaison librarian, and that's me. So that there was the start of an auspicious start of a relationship. So mm-hmm. we ended up getting married. But I also ended up leaving the University of Calgary and moved to the Geological Survey of Canada, which had an outpost across the road. Then it was called Institute of Sedimentary and Petroleum Geology. So it was the second largest geology collection in Canada outside the GSC collection in Ottawa.
And this was another librarianship position then?
It was. There was a librarian there who needed an assistant, but she was looking toward retirement. So really, she was bringing in someone that she hoped to groom. So within a year, I was acting head librarian of that library. So it was fantastic, you know, less than 3 years out of library school and I'm running my own library.
And that was a huge collection then. You said it was the second largest one.
It was. Yeah. And yes, it was a very rich collection of all kinds of geology, but not fossils that had backbones. There was some phrase in Canada that the National Museum took the backbone out of. And so this was some decision had been made that that would be the National Museum would do the dinosaurs and whatnot, and the Geological Survey would do the shellfish and
invertebrates.
Yeah, invertebrates and so on. So, I mean, this was in the days of big push for oil exploration and Conodonts and whatnot were all very much part of this whole search for oil grounds.
So how was it funded? Was it Canadian government or did some of the oil companies also fund the library?
It was totally Canadian government. Part of Energy, Mines and Resources Canada.
Right. Interesting. Huh. Yeah. So how long were you there for?
Until my second daughter was born, which was 1985. So I was there 83 to 85, so it was 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And that was another break in my career. Mm-hmm. I chose to focus on my infant for a while, knowing that I wouldn't walk in, they wouldn't hold my job for me. I asked for a leave of absence. They said, no, you come back or resign. So I didn't do it lightly, but I said, no, I'm putting my daughter first and I will see what's what when I'm ready to go back. Which ended up being teaching library technicians at SAIT, SAIT being the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology. Mm. So after all this of doing science I wasn't gifted at to avoid becoming a teacher.
You became a teacher.
The circle goes around and I did end up teaching. And 1987 until 1995. However, I did have 3 years off, 2 years doing a job exchange as a librarian at another college in Calgary, and 1 year kind of a sabbatical deal, which I spent in New Zealand.
Hmm. Nothing to do with the polar regions at all.
No. So my association with the group kind of dropped when I left the University of Calgary. So I didn't, there wasn't a listserv. I don't remember a newsletter. I didn't think of attending any of their colloquies while I was with the Geological Survey.
Right.
So I lost contact with the group to some extent.
So how long were you then teaching the library resources to the students?
Well, that was what I was doing in 1995. But somehow 14 years seems to be my limit anywhere. And I had been 14 years in Calgary, so things just were no longer going well. There was a downturn. SAIT was being cut every which way. Everybody was miserable. I was particularly miserable. And realized I just had to find another position somewhere. Could not find a position anywhere in Canada. Same. Interestingly enough, I even went for a job interview to Fort McMurray, which is now been evacuated. So right. I think, and managed to make the cut for as far as an interview, but didn't get offered the job. So I always laugh about that because someone said, you know, as a Canadian with a library degree, if you get a job offer in an American library, you can be a librarian in Canada with the NAFTA deal.
Oh, right.
And so I looked into that. That was the case. So I started applying for jobs in the States. Very quickly, I got called to go to Athens, Ohio for an interview. Mm. And the day, I think it was the same day that I got a very nice phone call saying they were awfully sorry, but they were going to hire the other candidate. It was the toughest choice they'd ever, you know. So they let me know that I'd been really close and that I hadn't done anything wrong. And I think it was that same day I got a phone call from Vassar. Would I go for an interview there? So one door closes, another door opens. And I just always think it's so funny that, you know, I couldn't get a job in Fort McMurray and I had to make do with Vassar.
Right. Which is a pretty prestigious college.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was so ignorant in 1995. I mean, a lot of these choices I did through sheer ignorance, not because I'd done careful research or, you know, carefully weighted decisions. I didn't realize until I went there for the interview and saw for myself that it had been co-ed since 1969. I thought it was still all female.
Right.
So I met lots of people coming to visit while I was there, also surprised it was co-ed. So I was always very empathetic with them. And I said, yes, I had to learn that myself. I hadn't known.
And so you were hired as a librarian for the university collection?
Yes, to be the science. They particularly wanted a science librarian. And so that was my job title. So again, you know, 15 years, but all good things come to an end. And I realized it really was time for me to move on. I'd had a wonderful time there, made wonderful friends, got on very, very well with the faculty and the students, but fell afoul of library administration and cast around wondering where I would go next. So I applied for a position at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland.
Oh, lovely.
And I applied for, actually, I had met Judy Triplehorn, who was the previous librarian in my current position. I'd met her at an SLA, and she and I knew each other.
And what is SLA?
A Special Library Association.
Okay.
And they have a wonderful annual meeting that I no longer attend because it's too blooming expensive. Mm. So I'm much happier going to the colloquy, which is very reasonably priced. She said, oh, Flora, would you be at all willing to consider a lovely position in Fairbanks, Alaska? And I said, you know, I just might. So it was actually Judy Triplehorn who encouraged me to apply.
And was she retiring then?
Yes, she knew she would be retiring. In fact, the university seems to move quite slowly about, well, now they're not filling positions at all with the economic downturn. But then they were doing things quite slowly. So she had retired and there was an interim brought in.
And this is the Geophysical Institute Library
on the West Ridge,
right.
Upper campus here on the university campus. So now I'm back in the position of a special librarian. We claim it's the northernmost special library in the world. So nobody has disputed that that claim of ours. So we don't think we're the northernmost library, but the northernmost special collection.
Right.
So lo and behold, an opportunity to get involved with this group that I had last met with in 1982 and by this time it's 2010, and we're in the days of the internet. So they have a web page, they have a listserv that I join, and communication is far easier.
Huh. Interesting. So just to make it clear, because this has always been some confusion for people, the geophysical library, the Mather Library, is not actually part of the other library, like this library here. It's its own entity, is it not?
Yes and no.
Okay.
So my position reports to the director of the Geophysical Institute, not to the Dean of Libraries. Okay. And the budget for the library collection comes from the Geophysical Institute, not from the university library's budget. However, we do use the same library system, so we don't have a separate catalog. All our materials are visible in the university library's catalog. All our journals, they're practically all online now. We now do IP recognition for the whole of campus, so we don't duplicate. In the old days when it was print, when I came in 2010, the Geophysical Institute Library was still getting a lot of print subscriptions, but I found easy acceptance amongst the scientists that they no longer needed print. They were willing to let it go, which meant we could eliminate duplicate subscriptions. So if Rasmussen Library had a title online, we let our subscription go and we picked up something that Rasmussen didn't get and shared that. So it's a separate shared resource.
Right.
And anybody with a Polar Express, a UAF ID card can come and use our library. They can come and borrow our materials. Anybody in Fairbanks with a Fairbanks Public Library card can use the materials. They need to register that card if they haven't already done so. But so as far as borrowing and use of the materials, it's as if we are a branch library.
So for you, was it a big learning curve for the Arctic component to the work when you took over?
I didn't think the Arctic was the tricky part so much as the geophysics. And, you know, so I still don't understand plasma or what plasma might really be. It's a fuzzy concept to me. So I would say that, you know, although they were pleased that I had a science background, I certainly did not have a geophysics background. Right. I had taken first year physics at St. Andrews, which when I compared that curriculum with somewhere like Simon Fraser, I saw that that was, you know, second year level courses were stuff I'd covered in first year. So, but still, that's not, and this was a long time ago, this was 1969 that
right.
I last had anything to do with physics. I would say the learning curve has been steeper in the physics part of it rather than the Arctic part of it. Because I like to go to lectures and seminars, and when I go to something about volcanoes or about glaciers, it's far easier to understand what they're talking about than if I go to magneto trails or solar storms or substorms or, you know, all this high physics work that they do with what's going on behind the beautiful aurora we get to watch.
Right.
So I still enjoy watching the aurora. I know a little bit more about the workings of it than I used to, but I still couldn't explain it and sound coherent.
So when you had this position, you said that you now, you know, we're in the age of the internet. So now the Polar Library Colloquy is online. You got to see it. Which was your, which event did you go to next? Do you remember?
Yes. So there was a conference. I'm going to say it was in 2012 in Boulder.
In Boulder, was it?
Yes. And I gave a presentation there on what I was allowed to do as an experiment at the Geophysical Institute. towards paying APCs, article processing charges, for open access. So I really wanted to promote that scientists publish their work open access. We all know, I mentioned back in 1981, University of Calgary was cutting journals. It's just an ongoing problem for libraries. They can never subscribe to all the journals their users want. They can never afford everything. Even Harvard can't. No library on earth can satisfy the demand of its readers for journals. And the publishers are merciless. The ones that have attracted the top scientists to their editorial board attract the best manuscript submissions, know that they can charge thousands of dollars for a subscription, and libraries will cut other things in order to have this must-have item. And it's not sustainable. I'm concerned that open access might not be sustainable either, but it's certainly a model where there's no such thing as a free lunch. It costs to publish. So the hang-up from the author's point of view, from the researcher's point of view, is to publish open access, the author pays rather than the reader or the library paying to have access. And why should they do this, I always tell them, is because study after study after study has shown that open access articles reach a bigger readership and get cited more frequently as a consequence. And it's not rocket science. I mean, if you make it available, people will use. And currently, I think about 20% of the literature is now open access. So it's made a dent, but we haven't reached a tipping point. It hasn't become the predominant model.
Is it also the case that if you pay for it, it's going to be published, whether it's a scholarly work or not? So as long as you pay the price, you can have as many papers published?
That is a very real concern. And there are certainly publishers who've sprung up out of the woodwork, particularly in India and China. And, you know, they claim that it's peer reviewed. They claim, they make all kinds of claims. But in fact, it is pay to publish. You give them your money and they'll put it on their platform. And it's, but they might have a genuine looking editorial board. They may have some very eminent scientists part of their editorial board. Sometimes these scientists don't even know that their names are there. Or sometimes they've agreed to do it not quite understanding what they were agreeing to. And then they find they can't sever the connection. And so that is an area of concern. However, that's now made itself a professional opportunity for me, because people are using librarian services less and less. They're just not asking reference questions the way they used to, because they can do it themselves. They've got Google and they can find what they need without a librarian. Often they can find what they need without coming to ask a librarian. So one of the things I offer to do is when they get solicited from a journal that they don't know, I say, just forward that to me. I will scope out the journal and tell you what my concerns with it are, or if I think it's bona fide and a good idea. You know, I'll just give you my findings. So that's, you know, become an interesting little sideline of the services I offer, is scoping out journals. But there are some excellent publishers out there. Copernicus is one, and the European Geophysical Union now has chosen them for a platform. In the States, Public Library of Science, who were one of the early players in this open access, they have become such a success story that they have spun off, I can't remember how many titles they now offer, but so they have a very high impact factor. They are actually, they have a turnaway rate, a rejection rate of something like 70%. So it's not just a matter of you pay your $3,000 and you get published. They are turning away 70% of, and they recognized that most of that 70% was good, valid science. It wasn't rubbish, and it was worthy of publication. They just couldn't cope with the flow. So they started up a new kid on the block. I think it started up in 2007, called PLOS One. And the idea was to be more rapid publication, less peer review. This was when it started up. They'd now gone more to peer review. But the notion was one of the editorial task force would take a look at the paper, look that it looked reasonable, that if you did these experiments, mm-hmm. you could come up with the kind of results that the authors said they got. And then they would publish it. It would go on their platform. And anybody could put comments on it. So I thought this was a wonderful notion because people would self-police. They wouldn't rush to publish some half-baked thing that they'd then look foolish and they wouldn't be able to take it down and they wouldn't be able to take down all these comments saying what was wrong with it. So I thought, and it quickly grew and they quickly got, I forget what their their rejection rate, I think is now at 40%. But it was a cheaper option, so it's about $1,000 APC to pub. It started out being that, it's now more. So there are several excellent opportunities that are not vanity press. They're not just pay to publish.
So this is, when you were in Boulder, this is what you were giving your talk on.
Yes. Oh. Well, but not just, so I gave a background about open access and why I thought it was important and why people should consider it. I think it's, by the way, I think it's particularly important that librarians who publish choose an open access venue and stay away from Taylor and Francis journals, because more and more libraries, as they're cutting journal subscriptions, they're forced to cut these professional library subscriptions because only the librarians tend to be the readers, unless it's somewhere with a library school. So who's going to read your work if you don't publish open access? So So I wanted to overcome, so, you know, I get people on board with open access publishing in a good journal is a good idea, but then they'd come to this $3,000 fee and that kind of made them gulp. And I was never suggesting that authors put their hand in their own pocket to finance this. So I talked the director of the Geophysical Institute in letting me use the money I'd saved from cancelling these duplicate subscriptions, which was $60,000 or something, to applying that to paying the article processing charges. So that ran for 3 years. It was very much appreciated, but finances have dwindled and the director said we can't continue it any longer. So everyone, I'm very sad about that. But meanwhile, some of the authors are now quite converted and they've built it into their grant requests. Right. So they're continuing to publish open access.
And how was your talk then received by the other librarians at the colloquy?
Well, they wanted to hear, at that time I had only just started it, I think I gave the talk in June or July, and I think I'd just started it that January, so it was quite fresh. So I didn't have data, I just had anecdotal, and I certainly had no data about a heavily cited paper, you know, because they were only newly published or, you know, within the last 6 months. So I knew that there'd be another colloquy in Cambridge, England. So I specifically called this talk part one because it was a fresh program and I hope to come back and speak to them again, you know,
two years later
and give them an update.
And so did you?
I did.
You did. So that was the one in Cambridge.
Yes. However, I had to be honest in that talk. I had only just got the word from the director that we weren't going to continue doing this in the coming financial year. So it was a good news, bad news story.
But by then, were more people on board then for the open access? Two years had gone by.
And... Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know that they would be, but, you know, that was, what are we saying, 2014? Here we are now at 2016. And I can't... Oh, well, a big publisher for the Geophysical Institute is the American Geophysical Union, the AGU. And they have an option. So their journals are... now published by Wiley, very, very expensive subscriptions. But authors can choose to make their paper open access if they pay an extra $3,000. So some of them are doing that. But if they do not, the AGU itself has come along and redone their rules about sharing, authors sharing their work. So the AGU rules now are that you can put your manuscript, your accepted manuscript, not the formatted publisher version, but the accepted manuscript, you can put in your institutional repository, on your homepage, in a subject repository. You can post it and share it 6 months after publication. So that's not quite open access, but 6 months is reasonable. And then the AGU now makes its journal content open access 2 years after publication, which wasn't the case at the 2014. So I feel that all this pushing and pushing and pushing, of course, it wasn't me. I'm not the only one pushing about this. There are far better people than me on board with this open access movement.
It's completely changing the way the libraries are operating and the way collections are operating.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And CERN, interestingly enough, that I didn't get a job with, Europe is far more on board with those open access, and they have more open access mandates than we do in North America. CERN just said all CERN research work will be open access. All results that are published will be open access. And so I was at a separate, wasn't a Northern Libraries colloquy, but I was at a small conference where this guy was giving his presentation. I put my hand up and I said, but Nature doesn't allow authors to share their work in an IR. And he said, that's right, we don't publish in Nature.
Wow.
Yes. So if CERN can do it. So I was hoping other institutes would follow, but no, people like the prestige of Nature, its fine reputation, and Nature has no difficulty getting top-notch submissions.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Huh. So getting back to the PLC, you can't go to this one this year because you're not going to be here.
Yes, I'm quite sad about that.
I know. But what have you enjoyed most about the PLC?
Well, like any conference with face-to-face opportunities, you finally get to see the person behind these postings on the listserv. Or actually, you encouraged me to go and get my facts straight before we started this conversation. So I continue visiting St. Andrews. I've got a very strong feel for the place, and I go there every summer, I would say. And I had a physicist friend who'd been a mentor of mine through my own years as a student there. And I would always go and visit him when I went to St. Andrews. And as he aged, I'd like to, you know, try and make myself useful around the place and, you know, do some chore or other. So one summer he said, well, you know, if you really want to help, but you could paint the front gate. And so he had a can of green paint, and I didn't have to do any prep or sanding or anything. It was just slap the paint on. So that seemed quite a fun occupation. While I was doing it, his next door neighbor came along the back lane walking a dog and stopped to chat to me. He didn't know who I was, and I didn't know who he was. And my friend David Finlayson came out, and said, oh, you know, you two should get to know each other. This is Doogie Benn, a glaciology professor at St. Andrews in the geology department. And this is Flora Grabowska, who works at the Geophysical Institute. Well, when I got back to work and got back to my library, I discovered that Douglas Benn's book on glaciology is never on our shelves. It's always out. It is the work that glaciology students use. Now, what has this got to do with Polar Libraries Colloquy? Well, I got an email from a librarian in Svalbard wanting to borrow some report of ours. I can't remember if she... So anyway, as we communicated by email about this transaction, I said, oh, you know, I just met somebody who's got a part-time position, and this same Doogie Benn has a part-time position at St. Andrews, and his other part-time is at the University of Svalbard. And she said, oh, yes, I know him very well. He comes in our library all the time, and he lives just down the road from me. So I thought, isn't this funny? I know both his neighbors. Doesn't matter where he is. I've got him cornered. So, you know, the world is a global village, and now with listservs, you get to discover these people that you know in common and have fun in ways like that.
And it's a great opportunity to meet and like-minded people, like-minded collections.
Yes, yes. And one of the fun activities that they do to raise funds for their scholarship is they invite attendees to bring something or other from where they've come from. That is then sold at a silent auction. And in fact, the Cambridge one, they had a hilarious live auction for some of the items too. It was raised significant money and was very entertaining.
And so what are the scholarships used for then, Flora?
Do you know, I've never, I may have read in the newsletter about the recipients, but that hasn't stuck with me. So I think it's... to help somebody come to one of these conferences, I think.
So they're like travel scholarships.
Yes,
right.
I think so.
Oh, interesting. So we've already kind of talked about it a little bit about how the librarianship is changing over the years. From when you first started, everything was in paper and buildings, to now it's in a virtual world somewhere.
Yes, it is, but... there's still a lot that hasn't been digitized, and the Geophysical Institute library collection, I forget what portion of it, but a high portion, like 70% of it, is unique, and there are no other holdings. And that's because a lot of our collection is grey literature. It's reports that were generated, and we have the last remaining known copy. And excuse me, while when we have copyright, like if it was a UAF report, then go ahead and digitize that for the University of Alaska Institutional Repository. But some of it is CREL or, you know, some other NASA or some other agency, and I would be infringing their ownership to just go ahead and digitize it and put it in a server somewhere without permission. So it would be great if it were all digitized, but it's not. And so we still have people. We are a huge net lender on interlibrary loan out of our collection. And there was a scientist from, I believe he's from Florida, who came to be a visiting scientist at the Geophysical Institute with the goal of launching a rocket from our UAF rocket launching pad at Poker Flat to conduct experiments in the upper atmosphere. And he wanted access to our report collection because in the 1950s, this had been done with barium release, barium being a tracer that you could then see what was going on when it got released because it would show up. But this technique, you know, he wanted specifics on how to do this, and that was in these early reports that maybe I didn't check the use of them, and I don't know if they'd have showed that. Some of them he did check out, others I just scanned or made copies for him. So it could look, if you looked at the CERC records of these reports, that they were never used, right, or they haven't been used since the 50s, but in fact they came to life again. So you can't say that it's just the recent literature that matters. Sometimes the early... I had a request, and this was for a real publication, not Grey Literature. It was a Wiley book published 1952 on antennas, and some technical institute wanted to borrow our copy, and I thought... You know,
so there's a cautionary note there of, you know, don't weed out the older books.
Exactly.
Because they actually still are really used for historical.
And as more and more libraries do weed them out, fewer and fewer libraries are left owning a copy. So until we get to the situation where it's all on the internet, libraries are... have a very important, I can't remember how many millions of dollars were involved in this recent rocket launching. I think it was like a year or so ago. I remember the date. It was the 25th of January. That's Robert Burns' date. I just don't remember the year, but I'll say it was 2014. And, you know, when you're doing this multi-dollar experiment, every scrap of information is really important and worth, we can't put a dollar value on it, but I think it's worth thousands of dollars.
Right.
Certainly, possibly worth my year's salary.
Yeah.
So to make that information available to him. So he was very grateful.
Hmm. You kind of alluded to it earlier about how the role of librarian is actually changing. You were saying people don't ask you as many reference type questions. So how is it? How has it evolved then since you've been in the career?
Well, I always look for opportunities to get questions. I'll even make the questions. So, you know, I'll go for coffee time in the director's circle upstairs on the sixth floor at the GI. And we chit-chat about anything, about the weather or about what we heard on the radio. But if a question comes up and nobody knows the answer, I'll make it my business to beetle back down to my computer and answer the question. And then I log that as a reference question.
Right.
As I say, this business about, we have a journal club that's graduates, physics students are supposed to attend, and the physics professors. But they had empty slots. They wanted people to come forward and offer to do one. So, of course, I'm not going to do a physics presentation to physicists. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, this is something that they might be interested in anyway. And so I offered, altmetrics were on my mind, but I didn't see that I could keep it interesting for an hour-long presentation. So I thought, well, I will throw in SciMago, which is a journal ranking tool, and I will also throw in BASE, which is a harvester of grey literature. So it's kind of, you know, it's a very useful tool when you want to find a report or a thesis, but you don't know, was it done at MIT, was it done at Caltech, was it done at the University of Edinburgh or Tokyo or where? So I turn, of course, you can use Google or Google Scholar for that too, but this BASE has some nice filtering tools and works very nicely. So I gave a talk on that and threw out the notion that, especially with the journal ranking part of my talk, that this was a service I was very happy. They could forget all about this tool other than it's something Flora knows about.
Right.
And whenever they are looking for a journal to send their manuscript, I'll happily, you know, look in SciMago and see what I can find for them, or if they've been approached by a journal that they wonder if it is a good idea.
Right, that you investigate that.
However, part of the reason I was late this morning is a new responsibility has been put on my plate, and that is the map sales office here in in the Geophysical Institute is the Alaska Satellite Facility operated a data management center which ran the map sales. Alaska Satellite Facility is winding down that part of their operations, and they're no longer going to continue map sales. Meanwhile, their staff were heartbroken at the idea of just shutting its doors and no longer being a service, because it is a valuable service. There used to be one in Anchorage, it closed down. It's the only one of its type in Alaska. There was, I think I heard that the one in Boulder closed down, or the one in Denver. I can't remember what I heard, but they are, you know, like libraries, they're just not the important, there's still a need, but it's a decreasing need. So I've been asked to take on the role of map sales. So I was just on my way to leave my desk to go and open the map sales office door at 9 o'clock, thinking, now what am I going to do? Because I have to be elsewhere shortly after 9 o'clock, and the student I thought would be here had sent an email saying he was sick. And just at that moment, a customer from the outside came in saying, "Who's opening the map office?" I said, "I am." At that, we hadn't got very far in the transaction when a different student came from upstairs who was now running the shop while I'm here chatting to you.
Wow.
So that's a much bigger learning curve for me than learning about the Arctic, is the ins and outs of selling maps.
Right.
It has the potential to increase the traffic. Currently, we're going to leave the map sales where it is, next door to the library. But that's a problem if it's one person running both things. I can't be in two places. So will I leave the door closed with a sign saying, "Come to the library for assistance"? Or will I put a sign in the library saying, "Come to the maps person"? Or, you know, I haven't quite worked out how this will go forward, if it's going to go forward at all.
So getting back to PLC, the Polar Library Colloquy, then, what do you think the future of that organization would look like? Or what would you like to see in the future of that organization?
I definitely believe it's going to continue. The listserv is trafficked. I choose to see the daily digest version of it rather than single emails. But my impression is there are days when there's nothing at all. So my impression is it's not burdensome in terms of email flow. It's certainly... librarians love to assist one another, and we know how miraculous we are to our users when we can get them something that isn't available in our library, and we get it because of the assistance of some other very helpful librarian, even if it's a librarian in Japan, in Svalbard. I will scan people, I will scan items for them, and they have scanned items for me. In fact, this Boreal Institute, I had sent them an email for something that they held in their collection that we needed. And they were a little bit hesitant because I think Canada has got extra copyright rules and they have to be very careful about sending PDFs around, but they decided to do it anyway, so I won't name any names as to who the helpful person was or what the item was, but it shows the strength of belonging to a group and the group knowing how we each benefit from the group efforts, and we can all make each other look good on occasion.
So So you're hoping to go to the next colloquy in 2 years? You can't go to this one.
But... Yes, and I meant to look and see if I knew where it was. I don't know if its location has been decided. I know the Fairbanks decision was made at the Cambridge, so it was fairly likely that it would be Fairbanks, but it was actually decided on, I believe, just 2 years ago. So maybe it's going to be decided mm-hmm. this summer where the next one will be. It usually switches from North America to outside North America. Mm-hmm. So it could be somewhere in Europe, or a lot of people were looking at the Japanese librarian when we were in Boulder and saying, you know, we'd come to Japan. And I don't remember there being a Chinese attendee. But yeah.
Yes, because the library itself doesn't have to be in the north. It's just to have northern collections or Arctic collections.
Polar collections.
Which is north and south, yes.
Yes.
As long as the collections are specialized in that way, then you can be part of the...
And apropos of nothing other than polar, I do think Britain missed a fantastic opportunity, and I think they were totally wrong not to let the popular choice of name Boaty McBoatface go forward for their new polar research ship. I like Sir Richard Attenborough, fine that he gets his name on things, but I think Boaty McBoatface would just have captured public support for, and had the public watching this boat and what discoveries were made off it, far more than naming it Sir Richard Attenborough. Yes.
So just to wind up, Flora, and I thank you for your time again, is there anything that we haven't mentioned about PLC or librarianship with polar collections that you'd like to touch on? I see you have some notes.
No, I've covered more than what was in my notes, but there was nothing that I meant to mention that I have forgotten about here. Back to my Tromsø. I've never been back to Tromsø. That was my one and only visit. Really memorable in so many ways. And because the Sami lecturer came and spoke in full Sami, colorful, festive costume, then when we were on an outing and there was a gift shop selling Sami handicrafts, I bought myself a reindeer skin hat with some Sami embroidery and some Sami decorated mittens. Now, I don't know that knitting had been in their original culture, but it was something they learned to do, and they had the fleece and the wool and the wherewithal. So I still have, from 1982, that hat and those mittens, and here they are in Alaska.
Right. Wonderful memories. Where do you see your career going from here now in involvement with the PLC in future?
I don't know that it will have much of a future once I leave my current position, but I have no plans to leave my current position. So my current plans are to stay and continue offering library services and perhaps map sales at the Geophysical Institute.
And maybe I'll be the new barista down there too soon.
And you mentioned Sandy Campbell, who's someone I did not know, although we're both Canadian librarians and both in Alberta. I had not known her prior to Boulder, Colorado. And, you know, so it is, and another, an American librarian, Laura Kissel, with the Bird Collection in Ohio. You know, she and I are now friends on Facebook, so we've got all kinds of other interests in common. But that was a result of meeting in Cambridge, and
it's a great networking opportunity.
Yes, yes. So I enjoy the group. I enjoy the aims of the group, which are very informal, but just to help each other out and make our collections as broadly available as we can to everybody.
That's wonderful.
Well, thank you, Leslie, for this opportunity.
Thank you, Flora. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.